This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. Terry Gross is on her midwinter vacation. In 1987, Jim Wright became Speaker of the House. He built the speakership into one of the most powerful positions in the government. The controversial Wright became the target of an ethics investigation by a House committee. He resigned the speakership in May of 1989. The story of Wright's rise and sudden dramatic fall is the tale of power in Washington. My guest, John Berry, has written that story in his new book, The Ambition and the Power. During Wright's final 2 years in politics, John Berry was at his side. When Berry began his book, Wright granted him permission to attend virtually all of his meetings where his staff was present. He also was able to attend many other private and confidential meetings as time went by. This access gave Berry a rare inside view of the workings of the Congress. Berry also conducted hundreds of other interviews for the book. John Berry is the former Washington editor for Dunn's Business Month. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Esquire. I asked him how he was able to get that degree of privileged access to Jim Wright.
Well, the book grew out of a profile I wrote for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And as soon as I did that profile, as soon as I met Wright, it became apparent to me that Wright was a very different animal, that his view of the speakership was totally different from his recent predecessors. He wanted to make it into an office almost equal to the presidency in power. I thought, and I know power is a zero-sum game. If Wright was going to have more, then somebody else was going to have less, and they were not going to yield power gracefully. So I thought it would be a good book. I asked Wright if he'd cooperate. What I really wanted was an hour of exclusive interview time a week, something like that. I asked him for access to private meetings. His staff objected, but to my amazement, he agreed. He said he didn't have the time to give me any exclusive interviews, but the access wouldn't be a problem. Why did he agree? I appealed to his sense of history. I think his decision also reflected a little bit of hubris on his part. And I think although he generally dislikes the press, it was some chemistry on our part between I used to be a football coach, and his first ambition in life was to coach football. And I think that's really a major reason as to why he agreed. And I want to add that he had no editorial control, did not read the manuscript before it was published, of course had no financial stake in it. And other members of Congress also cooperated with me and allowed them into private meetings. Newt Gingrich was, you know, extraordinarily candid with me during the 100th Congress as to what he was doing. So I was going back and forth, too. It wasn't just Wright who cooperated.
Politicians often get fascinated with the idea of being judged by history. I mean, Richard Nixon kept tapes in part because he wanted history to record what it is he'd been up to. Jim Wright let you in part because he was feeling historical. What goes on in a politician's mind? I mean, somehow I think it's dangerous when a politician begins viewing themselves in terms of a larger history.
I agree with you. I remember when Nixon was elected, I didn't think much of him, but I thought the nation could survive some petty crookery maybe. But what was dangerous was exactly what you said. These people want to do large things. And Wright, you know, there is hubris there. And I think what destroyed Wright was his hubris. It wasn't, this is not a tale of morality. It's a tale of power.
The staff didn't want you to participate in these meetings, didn't want you to be there. What was their fear?
Well, just the fear of, you know, they just didn't want a reporter on the inside when they didn't have any control over them. They just, you know, they felt that there were a lot of things that happen on the insides that should not be known on the outside. I mean, years ago, I mean, a century ago, Bismarck said, you know, you don't want to know how either sausages or laws are made. And, you know, this explains how sausages and laws are made.
I would think that after you spend a couple of years covering somebody that closely, that there might be tenuous threads of friendship that would develop. Did you ever find this a threat?
Well, you know, I do like Wright, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think a closeness did develop, frankly. I'll be honest about that. I don't think the book's an apologia for Wright, and I think the clearest evidence that it's not an apologia is that Newt Gingrich has publicly praised the book and even given me a quote to use in advertising it. So I think that's a pretty clear statement that I managed to retain my objectivity. I mean, I always knew that would be a problem that I had to be very careful of.
My guest is John Berry. His book, The Ambition and the Power, details Jim Wright's rise and fall in Congress. Jim Wright granted John Berry unprecedented access to attend virtually every private meeting in which he participated. One of the most startling episodes I remember from about 1987 was when Jim Wright was invited by the White House to participate in trying to bring about peace in Nicaragua. And Jim Wright sensed that there was perhaps a trap in the White House, but I also think he sensed that there was a power vacuum because the president at that time was at best inattentive.
Exactly. The liberals in the Democratic caucus initially fought his decision to go forward and join with the White House in that because they all foresaw the trap. In fact, in one of the meetings, Trent Lott, the number two Republican in the House from Mississippi, now in the Senate, blurted out, well, if that happens, the trap will have trapped us. Clearly the Republicans...
The trap being, I wonder if you could explain it.
Being a joint peace initiative by Wright and Reagan. I think Wright not only felt that there was a vacuum in the White House, but that a peace initiative at that particular time had a good chance to succeed. That was the only reason that I think, or at least the driving reason behind his decision to go forward. The liberals so opposed his initiative that he was, if it hadn't worked, I think he was risking his speakership right then. What they feared was that the peace initiative would collapse. As a result, the White House would turn around and say, look, we tried a diplomatic initiative. The Speaker of the House was with it, but it didn't work. Now give us more contra-aid. That was the fear of the liberals. And Wright, however, was in personal contact and had known for years people like Oscar Arias, the president of Costa Rica, Duarte, the president of El Salvador, Sergio Ramirez, the vice president of Nicaragua. And he talked to all those people, and he sensed a possibility of something happening. The White House had no idea that possibility existed. I think if they had, they probably would not have proceeded with the initiative. And, of course, Wright was proved correct.
Part of this, then, was that the conservatives also feared that if it succeeded, Wright would have far more power to put through the progressive agenda that people such as Newt Gingrich opposed. And was this at the point that Newt Gingrich decided to take on Wright as being a corrupt and an abusive man?
Actually, Gingrich had decided several months even before that to take him on. And again, it's a tale of power. It's not a tale of morality. In April 87, that's when Gingrich decided to begin his ethics campaign against Jim Wright. He said to me about that time that it's clear if Wright ever consolidates his power, he'll be a very formidable man. We've got to take him on early to prevent that. That was right after Wright had passed a budget through the House without a single Republican vote, which was quite unusual. Now, a few years earlier, Gingrich had called Tip O'Neill corrupt and had vowed to drive O'Neill from office, but he had abandoned that campaign because he was isolated. And the reason he was isolated was that the Republicans liked Tip O'Neill personally. Wright was different because of the way Wright used power. He was making the Republicans entirely irrelevant and making a lot of enemies.
You quote Newt Gingrich as saying that in politics, it's just very hard to have a personal relationship. It probably attracts those who in part get their ego needs from a larger audience because they're too frightened to get it from a smaller audience. Would you say this is true of politicians that you've met and spent? And what goes on that makes them fear the kind of smaller audience?
They all have driving egos. That's a very interesting question. Most politicians appear to be extroverts, but I think very few of them are. In fact, I can remember having dinner once with a couple of members of the Congress, of both Republicans and Democrats, and we were talking about that, and one of them said that he didn't think there was a single extrovert, it was a Republican, on his side of the aisle. They were all introverts. And Les Aspin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said, yeah, I think an extrovert is a person who will sit down next to you on an airplane and start talking. Don't you hate that, he said. They're very much into themselves. They need those egos to survive in the game. It's a very rough game. They take a lot of criticism. And that's what... You know, I think a lot of them are flawed psychologically, but if they were less flawed, they'd be less ambitious and less driven. And all the success, I think that's true of most very successful people in all walks of life. They are driven people. And that's because there's something there that leaves them unsatisfied.
You set up a parallel between Jim Wright and Thomas Foley, now Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. Very different sets of drives. Thomas Foley seems not the driven man that Jim Wright was, yet Thomas Foley has risen and has a great deal of power and respect now. Could you explore that dynamic a little bit and those differences?
They're about 180 degrees mm-hmm. opposite. Mm-hmm. Wright, I've been in Washington a dozen years covering politics, and Wright was probably the most ambitious politician I've ever met. This is not to say that he didn't have ideals. Foley is very laid back, not only in style, but I don't think he has an agenda. The way that Wright had an agenda. Wright really took office as Speaker knowing exactly what he wanted to do. Foley was never an empire builder. He was more intellectually challenged by being in the leadership. I think that's why before he became the House Whip back in 1981, he was chairman of the Agriculture Committee. And it's very unusual for a chairman to give up a post to be even the majority leader, the number two slot, much less the number three slot. Somebody else, someone like a John Dingell or a Dan Rostenkowski would have built an empire out of the Agriculture Committee. They would have, it gets into the securities markets through the trading of commodities. It gets into international politics through agricultural exports in it. There was a lot of potential there to build an empire, but Foley didn't do that. Instead, he liked the intellectual challenge of dealing with a lot of other issues.
It seems almost a Zen approach to power compared to Jim Wright. By not seeking it, he now has it.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's got a greater sense of pace, probably, than anybody at his level in politics. By the same token, he has yet to show that he's got the kind of leadership ability that Wright had. Whether you despise Wright or revere him, the guy had guts. He had the courage to go out there on his own and to make waves.
You quote somebody in the book as saying, I think it's George Miller, the congressman, the Democrat from California, mm-hmm. is saying, we have a little machine here that if you stick your head up too far,
hedge clipping service, come
along and slice it off.
That's exactly right, and that's in the prologue. Interestingly, Miller and Foley had a little run-in that might sort of exemplify the difference between Wright and Foley. There was a dramatic vote on the House floor, and Wright was trailing, ended up winning it by one vote. And Miller, who had earlier in the day told Wright, "I'm not going to let you down, Mr. Speaker," walked in to the House chamber in an emotional state, and for a reason entirely unrelated to the bill, anger at Wright over something else, voted no and stormed off the floor. Foley went after him and caught him at the elevator outside the House chamber and said to George, we're going to lose this thing. And Miller said to him, "Don't come near to me, Tom. I'm mad as hell." And Foley said, "Well, I just thought you'd voted by mistake." And Foley watched Miller take the elevator and leave the floor. And again, it led to a very dramatic moment on the House floor. But I don't think Wright would have let Miller just walk away like that. Neither would Tony Coelho, the House Whip, nor would a lot of others. But Foley didn't feel it was his preserve, or I don't know if that's the right word, but to try to drag Foley back onto the floor. I mean, to drag Miller back onto the floor. Or even really to try to convince him to reverse his vote. He just let him go.
It struck me that there were a lot of unspoken rules of behavior in the House that sometimes could function like tripwires.
Right.
I wonder if you could explain what some of these were.
Well, Wright violated a few of them, which I think is why he's not Speaker right now. One is, and maybe the most important, is that the members of Congress believe that the leadership is there to serve them. They are a constituency, just as the district is the constituency for the member. And when they want a favor, whether it's help raising money or something as small as being allowed to use a vacant office down the hallway to store a laser printer, they expect the leadership, meaning the speaker, to perform that service for them. And that, for example, would require Wright or any speaker to be on the floor of the House or in the cloakroom where he's accessible to the members. Tip O'Neill lived on the floor and in the cloakroom. Everybody knew where they could find him. Wright did not. And the reason was Wright had his own agenda. Tip O'Neill believed in the saying that the president proposes, Congress disposes. Wright did not believe in that saying. In fact, quoting it to him used to really annoy him. So Wright didn't have time to spend on the floor of the House dealing with other members' issues, and because he needed to use that time to push his own agenda. But, you know, there's an interaction between the two. If you're not serving them, then they're not going to vote for you. They're not going to give you their vote. And Wright never struck that proper balance. I asked him about that once because I knew Tip had spent so much time there, and he said to me, well, I'd like to schedule more time for the floor. But the very idea of scheduling time to be on the floor would have been foreign to Tip O'Neill. That's where all his power comes from. And I think Wright, again, lost sense of that. Another one is in the way you use parliamentary procedure. Wright was very, very rough in the way he did that. And you can make a strong case, the Republicans would certainly argue, that he abused his power in that regard. The vote we were talking about a few moments ago, said a dramatic vote, that occurred in October 87. And Wright had lost a vote at noontime. At 3 o'clock, it was on a tax bill, right after the stock market collapsed during the budget summit talks. House rules prohibited him from bringing the bill back for another vote the same day. So he adjourned the House at 3 o'clock and reconvened it at 3:15. Technically, this created a new legislative day and allowed him to bring it back for a second vote, which he barely won, 206-205. But it clearly violated the spirit of the rules of the House.
And a lot of the members must have certainly felt duped.
The Republicans were absolutely outraged. Dick Cheney, now Secretary of Defense, said at the time, he called Wright a heavy-handed son of a bitch. That he taught us that Republican votes don't count as much as Democratic votes. Now, that feeling is what allowed Gingrich to go forward. I think, in a way, Wright's speakership, you know, to say it was doomed would be a little bit too strong, but it really, you know, passed a major test at that point in time. And after that, Republicans, whenever Newt said something vicious against Wright, they cheered him on instead of isolating him. It was a very important moment.
I was struck by a number of anecdotes in your book that led me to believe that these politicians carry grudges for very long times. They've got long memories about small slights and larger ones, and that affects their judgment and how they work.
Absolutely. You know, it's a very personal place. There was whether it's the assignment of something as small as a parking space can affect a vote, you know, years later.
You noticed a demarcation between congressmen who were elected in before 1974 and those after. What is the nature of that demarcation? How does that affect the power structure of the House?
Well, of course, the 74 election was the post-Watergate election. Democrats gained 49 seats in the House. Many of them were from marginal districts. Or even outright Republican districts. And the Republicans expected to get those seats back, and they haven't. And I think that's why the Democrats continue to control the House.
It made for a more contentious group of congressmen?
Well, what it really did, I think, was made these people from largely Republican or mixed districts more cautious. And you know, plus they were generally not party hacks that came in. It wasn't only the 74 election, but that's the single biggest group. There were most of those people were outside the political process. and ran for the Congress for the first time and won. So they didn't owe anything to the Democratic Party. That's one of the reasons that Wright ran into trouble, because he was putting forward a complete, comprehensive agenda. But Wright's real problems were less ideological ones, at least on the Democratic side, than some of the ways he used procedures.
Did Jim Wright ever admit to you that maybe he went too far?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he said that publicly now, but it's a little bit late.
What has been his reaction to your book?
Well, he dislikes, I guess it's the bulk of the book, really, which details how power is used, because that does portray him as not power-hungry but and ruthless, although I think he was doing it not for megalomaniacal reasons but to push through his agenda. But he's obviously very happy that it says he's not a thief, in effect, and pretty much all the reviewers have been convinced by the evidence in there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being on the Fresh Air with us today.
Well, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
John Barry's new book is The Ambition and the Power, The Fall of Jim Wright, A True Story of Washington. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.